Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Well, a lot has changed since we discussed the coronavirus on yesterday's show. The number of cases has risen to 100,000, according to Johns Hopkins University. The global death toll is now 3,080. Here in California, the number of cases has grown to 66, and government officials say the virus is expected to spread. California became the latest state to order insurance companies to waive all costs for testing. Washington State and New York regulators issued similar orders this week. Meantime, Donald Trump has doubled down on his dangerous rhetoric and lies by saying that the coronavirus will, quote, go away. He said that this morning after signing an $8.3 billion emergency spending bill to deal with the virus. He also had to question the number of deaths. He said, deaths? Is it 11? He also said in terms of cases, it's very, very few because we've been very strong at the borders. Well, joining us to talk about media coverage is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. She was worked as an emergency room physician before becoming a journalist. She is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Rosenthal is a former New York Times correspondent. She reports that it's been nearly 3 months since the first case of COVID-19, and it's now a global outbreak, and yet the world doesn't have basic information about this outbreak. Hi, Dr. Rosenthal. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm tripping over my words because I just can't believe what Donald Trump is still saying. I mean, it's just he's saying that the coronavirus will go away and we have few cases because we've been strong at the borders. I mean, Dr. Rosenthal, how should the media cover these dangerous lies?
Well, I think both the media and politicians they make these kind of crazy blanket statements, frankly, that don't represent the complexity of an outbreak like this. And of course, we have no idea whether COVID-19 will go away. And of course, yes, you can prevent the spread by instituting travel restrictions or closings of schools. But we really have to deal with it as science. Now, likewise, I hold the press somewhat accountable for doing things like saying, they continue to call it the deadly coronavirus outbreak. Well, flu has killed far more people this year. And they report that the WHO said, over 3% of people who get it will die of this disease. That's totally out of context as well. I mean, what we know is that in a small study or in a cohort of hospitalized people who are sick, maybe 3% will die. But the big information we don't know right now is what's the denominator. How many people out there are sick and think they just have a cold? And that may be huge. So I think we're coming down to a conclusion that the mortality rate of this particular illness may be a lot closer to the seasonal flu or lower. And of course, how you respond depends on knowing just how lethal this thing is. And what I objected to in that New York Times piece I wrote was, we still don't have a lot of basic information, and some of the problem is science, and some of it is politicians who kind of don't want to know always how widespread this is, because it kind of looks bad if it's spread all over the place and you haven't done anything about it.
Right. So given that this is how Trump is talking, people are really relying on media for the latest. And you mentioned this a bit, but how do you think the media should cover a story that is changing so rapidly? You've got major outlets like The Washington Post and The Guardian, and they have live updates, and so things change very quickly. Like, I'm just refreshing the Washington Post page. A French lawmaker tested positive. The Vatican reported its first case. Netherlands recorded its first fatality. We have a cruise ship quarantine off the coast of San Francisco. The University of Washington is going to shut classrooms through March 20th. I mean, the list is really long.
Yep, and they're going to be things that sound alarming out of context. And there, this is something to be cautious about and to be prepared about. But, you know, like my husband will say to me, did you see the death toll is now 3,000? And I think, yes, that is a serious number, but that's a top line. What we have to remember is the death toll of the flu this year in the United States alone is 16,000. So I think we have to address things carefully, with caution, and not overinterpret what's going on. You know, you hear, oh, a school is closing down. Well, that's kind of the better side of caution, perhaps. If you have a case, you don't want it to spread because we don't yet know enough about this virus. But I like to remind people it's kind of like why we give our kids measles or chickenpox vaccine. It's not because in this day and age in the United States we think they're actually going to get these diseases because the prevalence is pretty low, but because we need to prevent these diseases from resurging. So a lot of what we're seeing now when we talk about pandemic preparedness is not because I feel like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to be at mortal risk tomorrow, but because we don't want this to spread widely until we know more about it. And what we do know so far about this virus, which is the part that is worrisome, is if it gets into a nursing home, it can be really bad, because this disease, like influenza, seems to really hit elderly or medically compromised people really bad. On the bright side, influenza, often some of the strains of influenza kill young people, kids, 20-somethings. We are not seeing this with this strain of the, with this cold virus. So, you know, again, things to be optimistic about, things to be cautious about, things to be prepared for, but not like the sky is falling, this is the end of the world.
Well, you mentioned the nursing homes, and we have about 10 people have died in Washington State. Yeah. Most of those who died were residents of the Life Care Center, a nursing home in Kirkland, a suburb east of Seattle. And just yesterday, families with loved ones who died demanded more information. They said that they felt that it just wasn't handled well.
Yeah, and you know, the problem is when you're the first facility to get an outbreak, it's very easy to say, you know, you should have known this wasn't just the cold or a flu, that you should have known it was a coronavirus. When you're the first, it's hard to know. The second, you should have known. And I noticed that my mom, who's in an assisted living facility, they shut down group activities for the moment. So I hope and I assume that Washington area, that areas where there are a lot of cases, particularly in Washington State, that nursing homes are taking precautions and not assuming that, you know, someone with a runny nose and a cough just has a seasonal cold, because that's part of the problem, too. There's lots of stuff that goes around in the winter, and most of it will not be coronavirus. Most of it will not be influenza, but you have to be on the lookout and have your antenna up, and I think that's part of the problem. It's easy, you know, in between outbreaks, in between epidemics, to kind of let your guard down and be complacent about things like infection control. And one of the things, you know, that I think everyone should realize, and what's alarming to me, is we here at Kaiser Health News looked at data and discovered this week that I think it's about half of nursing homes with 5-star ratings have been cited for lapses in infection control. So just because you're in a fancy place doesn't mean they're good at infection control. And that's the kind of boring stuff that families and patients may not notice, but really is key to the safety of older residents.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. She worked as an emergency room physician before becoming a journalist. She's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She's also a former New York Times correspondent. Dr. Rosenthal, you are perfectly positioned to report on this given your background as a doctor, and now you're a journalist, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. What questions are outstanding? What questions do we still need to answer?
Well, I think we don't know what the range of illness this virus causes, right? How many people are asymptomatic? How many people just have the sniffles, something mild. And that's just hugely important to know how to respond, because if it turns out to be just another winter cold virus that circulates, then, you know, you take a certain kind of precaution, but if, you know, you don't close schools for that. Now, if it turns out to be more aggressive, in the range of influenza or above, you up the kind of precautions you take. In the meantime, you know, I was also a reporter in China during the SARS outbreak, and I can tell you the most important thing, and it sounds really boring, is, you know, wash your hands. Don't, you know, if you're sitting next to someone who's coughing or sneezing a lot on a train, move to another seat. But, you know, it's really that simple. Wash your hands. Don't go to work if you're sick. Don't send your kid to school if they're sick. My two kids stayed in China in their school, as we did all through the SARS outbreak there, and the school stayed open, but they were vigilant about not letting sick kids come into the school and hand washing. And you know what? No one got SARS in that school, and no one got stomach bugs or, you know, normal winter colds. So it is really effective. And I think we have to remember that the kind of transmission we were hearing about in central China at the beginning of this outbreak, which was the most alarming, high death rates, you know, huge number of health professionals infected at one hospital, was before they understood that this was a new virus circulating. And so they weren't taking all the precautions that we now know to do.
Well, we have a related question from a listener who says, can you please give us practical information to protect people from both the flu and COVID-19? This listener writes, I believe our policies, including sick leave policy and the lack of sick leave, we talked about this yesterday, protecting healthcare workers and vulnerable populations, hand washing, not sharing pens, staying home. Can you comment and can you tell people what you know about how to protect themselves?
Yeah, and I do think this issue of sick leave is a big issue in the United States. You know, people are, they don't want to lose pay or lose a vacation day. So that is something we have to address at a policy level. On a practical level, you know, someone said to me, how many times a day do you wash your hands? It's probably 20. I just kind of go around, and as I do things, before I eat, I wash my hands. After I eat, I wash my hands. You know, it should become a habit, particularly when you in flu season. And I don't think I'm doing it more because of coronavirus, but having worked in an emergency room and lived through SARS, it's just a habit I got into, and I think everyone should do it more. The other thing people need to remember, because they tend to focus on the people who are coughing or sneezing, is many of these viruses transmit best on surfaces called fomites. So it really makes me kind of crazy when you see people wash their hands before they eat, and then they go to like a salad bar and are using a scooper that, you know, 100 people have used before them, and then they put things directly in their mouths. So you have to be kind of conscious of the surfaces you touch and what you touch and how many people have touched them as you're washing your hands. You know, you wash your hands after you've scooped out your salad, not before.
You should also wash your cell phone, right?
Yeah, you know, I had a physician in my office the other day who said he thought cell phones were the biggest fomite known to man at the moment, because, you know, we put them down, we pick them up. You know, I go over mine a few times a day with a wipe, a disinfectant wipe. When I go to the gym after I'm there, I you know, wipe it off as I wipe my hands off. But, you know, I still am going to the gym. I'm planning to take the train up to New York this weekend from Washington, D.C. But it's that extra layer of caution and hand washing and disinfecting that, you know, your hands will be dry, but you not only will keep you yourself safer, but you'll prevent viruses from spreading to others who, if you're young and healthy, may not, you know, may be more vulnerable than you are. So
we have another question about clothing. Can the virus live on clothing?
That's a hard answer. I don't know the exact answer to that, but not as well as it does on a surface. So I don't know that we know that, but I don't know. Are you worried about touching someone else's clothes?
Well, this listener said, what's the best way to wash our clothes?
Oh, just wash them normally.
Yeah.
You just really have to do what you do normally. You know, normally, you know, I tell people if they're going to the gym, wipe off the equipment before and after rather than maybe just after. You know, so you protect yourself. You take a little extra step of precaution, but a little goes a long way in preventing the spread of viruses. And this, by all accounts, does not spread as easily as something like measles, but probably a little easier than, you know, than something like SARS, where you actually had to be in quite close contact. So,
another listener wants to know, where is the best site for reliable statistics? I cited Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah.
What else can you recommend?
That's what we're using. Johns Hopkins is the site that we're relying on at the moment. They're pulling together data from a lot of different sources. I think the thing people have to remember is any one number can be taken out of context. And a physician friend of mine suggested that maybe side by side with our coronavirus tracking of where it is and how many people are sick and how many people have died, we should have a side by side map of influenza and how many, you know, where the disease is now. It's in, I believe, all 50 states. There have been hundreds of thousands of cases and over 10,000 deaths. So it's important to be careful, but also to keep it in perspective and not, you know, react rationally rather than with alarm.
Well, thank you for those questions. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Harvey. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show. Oh, do we not have Harvey? Okay. We have a bunch of emails. Lot of the questions we also got yesterday, Dr. Rosenthal, was, you know, what people can do to protect themselves. And our guest yesterday said that if you're a citizen, it really doesn't make sense to wear a mask.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. And I think it's, you know, masks are, first of all, outdoors, it's really hard to get anything, you know, if you're outdoors in enclosed spaces. What I tell people is even through SARS, when I was on airplanes, I did not wear a mask. I carried one with me in those cases only in case the person next to me on the plane, if I couldn't change my seat, was coughing a lot. But, you know, a mask, it's great for healthcare professionals if someone is coughing in your face. But on a day-to-day basis, there's just no reason for wearing one. I don't. I do as I say, and I am not wearing a mask. I won't wear a mask on the train. You know, I guess people feel comfortable. Some people feel protected, but it really doesn't protect against the virus. And the thing that really amuses me is when, or amuses me and shows me how ignorant people are about this kind of stuff, is, you know, you see a picture of everyone wearing masks and then they take them off to eat. Well, there you go. You know, the protection's gone because that surface where you're eating is probably more of a problem than sitting in a dining room with other people, as long as you're not sitting in a tightly enclosed space with a lot of other people where one of the people is really sick and coughing. So the people who are sick should be wearing the mask, but not the people who are well.
We have another question. What is the cause of death for these patients? Respiratory failure, organ failure, cardiac failure?
Well, as far as we know, it's a respiratory failure. It's a pneumonia, basically, so you don't get enough oxygen. And again, the people who have died, as far as we know, far and away, are people with other underlying illnesses, so they're more vulnerable to all infectious problems and to lung problems in particular. Now, that doesn't mean, as I think Tony Fauci from the NIH said, that there isn't going to be somewhere someone who's, you know, a otherwise healthy 30-year-old who bad luck gets this and maybe dies. But that happens with the flu every winter, too. There are a number of bad luck deaths, so where maybe they didn't, you know, get help soon enough. Maybe there was something, they got a huge dose of the virus. You just never know. But really, you know, it's like being worried about being hit by a bus when you're crossing the street with the walk sign. Yes, sometimes it happens, but you don't want to worry about those really far out events.
We're getting a lot of questions that we addressed on yesterday's show.
Yeah.
So I would just want to take one more of them, and then I want to ask you a bigger picture question. Mm-hmm. Some people are saying, how long does this virus live, for example, on a dry surface?
Well, I think those are the kinds of questions we don't quite know for sure. And remember, you know, living like one virus particle living is different than, a huge dose of virus living. So there's the theoretical, how long can a virus survive and how infectious is it after, 5 minutes? And I think we don't know the answer to that yet. But it's not like there is danger lurking on every surface. You don't know who's been in the room before you. I think it's really easy to get to make yourself crazy about the unknowns. You do what you do during flu season. That's the best advice I can keep giving people. And it is really smart advice.
Well, we will continue to do shows with a lot of these what should I do questions, but I want to ask you a bigger question, Dr. Rosenthal, yeah, about media, because we had on someone from the National Nurses United yesterday. Uh-huh. We had on Michelle Mahan, and they just conducted a nationwide survey of nurses and frontline staff, and they found, according to these nurses, that the vast majority of hospitals and healthcare facilities are unprepared to handle the cases. And Michelle said yesterday, it's not just under the Trump administration. We had a lot of problems under Obama, under Bush, under Clinton. She said these are very long problems that have not been dealt with yet. So what are your thoughts about the media's responsibility to really dive into these issues and figure out what is happening with public health and what does public health mean when we have a for-profit healthcare system?
Yeah, there are, we do know that many public health programs have been eroded over the years, and that's alarming, right? Pandemic response requires a quick action. It requires protective gear. It requires ventilators. It requires contact tracing. I think the problem becomes, when at the start of this outbreak, everyone's alarmed, and are we going to need all these ventilators? And then slowly we discover, well, it looks like it's not going to be that bad, and the worry recedes into the background. So, politicians deal much better with the problem today than a problem that might happen that we have to be prepared for. So I do think it's important that nurses and doctors keep bringing this up, and it's probably not going to get you a lot of votes until there's a really scary pandemic, and maybe this one is scary enough to remind people that we shouldn't neglect these important public health functions that our system in particular is not very well poised to address, because it is a system that's largely for profit. All of our hospitals are in theory, or most of our hospitals are in theory, not for profit, but they look very carefully on which services make money and which don't. They all in theory do what we call charity care and community benefit, but I think many people feel like they could do a lot more in that department. So maybe one community benefit that we should ask more of our hospitals for is pandemic preparedness.
Kaiser Health News has been writing about what's happening at the federal level. Mother Jones has a piece, "Here Are 17 Ways the Trump Administration Bungled Its Coronavirus Response." And they have a list, a couple of things. Last month, the Trump administration in its budget announced cuts that would reduce CDC funding by 16% and slash $3 billion for global health. In 2019, the National Security Council's global pandemic director left his post abruptly. His entire team was abandoned by John Bolton. Fewer than 500 people have been tested for the virus in the U.S. compared with over 13,000 in the U.K. I mean, there's just so much here. So given that, Dr. Rosenthal, how should the media report on this?
Well, this has been reported on, and I think, we do know that a program called PREDICT, which was part of USAID, specifically to look at these kind of global pandemics that arose from animals, was defunded a couple of years ago. Hey, that's a problem. I think there's been considerable concern about how slow the U.S. was to get out approved testing kits. But I am a little concerned that these responses or non-responses get politicized on both sides of the aisle, and that's not good either. It's not good to kind of say, because I do think public health has been underappreciated, not just in this administration, but in previous administrations as well. So there's a lot of blame to go around, a lot of finger-pointing, a lot of the responsibility of dealing with this on a day-to-day basis falls to the states, and as we know, the states are not terribly well-supported in this effort by the federal government at the moment, and that does have to do with defunding of public health programs.
Well, we don't have time for Susan's call, but she wonders if it's time for people to start stockpiling food in case things start to shut down.
I can only tell you what I do, and I am not stockpiling food. But we have a lot of pasta in the, you know, in the cabinet anyway. No, I don't think that's necessary at this point. At this point, the outbreaks are fairly limited. We know where they are. There's a lot of panic buying, but I hope that will subside because I think we are now seeing the kind of response we need, and there will be cases. There will be new cases. I can't tell you if it's for weeks or for months. I don't think this thing is just going to go away, but I think we're doing the responsible things now to ensure that we control this outbreak and move past it. I do think people would be wise to make sure they have, you know, a month of any medicines they need, you know. But beyond that, I can only tell you that I'm personally not stockpiling, and I don't think there's any reason to do so.
Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal worked as an emergency room physician before becoming a journalist. She is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Rosenthal.
Thanks for having me.
And I should say, KALW is connected to a school here in San Francisco, and we don't know if the school is going to shut down, but if it does, we still will be on the air. We'll just be hosting the show remotely. And we also made a decision today that if this continues to spread, every single day we will bring you updates, because now more than ever, public media is so important to really educate people about what is going on, especially with a government, a federal government like this. Coming up after the break, we will discuss media coverage of Super Tuesday and where we go from here. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about the fallout from Super Tuesday. Joe Biden is now the front runner after winning 10 states, including Texas. Bernie Sanders won 4 states, including delegate-rich California, and the votes are still being counted here, so we do not have the delegate numbers yet. And Elizabeth Warren dropped out yesterday, and she has not endorsed another candidate at this time. Joining us to talk about coverage is Helene Olin, an award-winning journalist and opinion writer at The Washington Post, where she focuses on politics and economics. Helene is author of the book Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Hi, Helene. Welcome to the show. We're also joined by Lee Fong, an investigative journalist and staff writer for The Intercept, focusing on how public policy is influenced by organized interest groups and big money. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Lee. So much has changed in the last week and a half. We saw that after Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg dropped out, they quickly endorsed Joe Biden. And then you had a number of Democrats like Beto O'Rourke, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer coalesce behind Biden. And there's been, you know, tensions are really high right now. And there's been a lot of talk about what happened with Biden and, you know, why he got just so much support in states where he didn't really have a ground game. And then why Bernie didn't do as well with young people like he said he would. I mean, so many questions here. What really stands out for you in terms of the media coverage that we're seeing right now? I mean, I know it's a big question.
It is a big question.
There's so many angles and there's a social media. It's ugly. I mean, we got some emails that I want to talk about with you about how people are offended that we say corporate wing of the Democratic Party.
Well, increasingly, and I'm part of this, we get our media from social media, from Twitter and Facebook and other platforms. And I think the danger of this is that we're creating filter bubbles where, you know, we see content that confirms our own biases. And, you know, I try to read everything across the ideological spectrum, but even, you know, I fall victim to this. And, I was surprised by a lot of the exit polls and a lot of the results on Tuesday. And you look at the kind of data on a granular level, not only did Biden win extremely big victories in states where he didn't run ads or didn't have a field operation, places like Arkansas and Oklahoma, and then won huge victories that, you know, came together overnight. Bernie was up 15 points, 10 points in Minnesota, and then Biden then wins that state big. So, you know, that seems shocking. But then if you look at the exit polls, it's another story altogether. Bernie did very well with youth voters both times. But in 2016, his numbers and youth turnout was much higher. Youth voters turnout collapsed this election. Why? I don't think we have a great explanation of this. You know, I've been like consuming analysis and stories about this election on an hourly basis for the last few months. And I haven't seen a strong explanation why youth voter turnout collapsed. And even in Vermont, in Bernie's home state, youth voter turnout was down to 10%. I mean, that's abysmal. Mm. And, you know, this was Bernie's base. Even the exit polls. The exit polls or the general polling over the last 3 months showed Bernie actually making some headways with African-American voters where, you know, he performed kind of poorly with 4 years ago. And it looked like he had gained the trust of a lot of African-American voters. But up until Tuesday, that seemed to be the case. But once Tuesday happened, his support collapsed. Even among first-time voters, voters who are voting for the very first time in their lives or who didn't vote in the last few elections, they actually broke for Biden. You know, the Bernie kind of mantra that he would bring out new voters, he would change the electorate, he would bring out working class and alienated voters who hadn't participated in the election system. Maybe they did come out because of Bernie's message, but eventually they voted for Biden.
Right. Helene, you wrote a piece in The Washington Post called Will Democratic Primary Voters Suffer Yet Another Case of Buyer's Remorse? How do you think the media, I mean, it's a big question, and you can't explain all of this in one piece, but what are the main, I guess, bullet points that the media should focus on after the major changes that we saw?
I think this election has had this obsession with electability. Mm. I mean, people always obviously want to vote for a winner, but I don't think any of us has ever seen something, an election where everybody is, not everybody, but most people are saying they would rather see somebody in office, you know, win from the Democratic Party and vote for that person over somebody they believe is electable versus their own policy position. So, like, one of the things you saw coming out of the exit polls on Tuesday was that there is, you know, a decent majority of people want to see something like Medicare for All. But on the other hand, they're not voting for candidates who will do that. They're voting for Joe Biden, who is most certainly not. And I think this electability thing is becoming, in the same way that going on Twitter and going into social media leaves you kind of in your own silo, I think electability is becoming the same sort of silo where people are just, you know, sort of thinking, well, what is electable? Oh, you know, I think my Republican, you know, uncle will vote for Joe Biden. Or I'm hearing on MSNBC that moderates are more electable. And it becomes a sort of weird feedback loop where, in fact, we have no idea if who is the most electable. And it's something I've really become sort of obsessed with, is what is electability? How do you determine it? And why do people think what they're thinking? And it doesn't seem to really have an answer to this question right now.
Well, we decided to do a whole series on where the presidential candidates stand because you just weren't hearing about real issues, especially in the broadcast media. And I also just want to ask both of you what you think about some of the coverage, because after South Carolina, Biden was getting wall-to-wall, mostly uncritical coverage on the cable shows. There was hardly any attention about the massive rallies that Bernie Sanders held over the past 2 weeks and the money that he raised, mostly from teachers and then workers. And then Elizabeth Warren was hardly even mentioned.
Right.
There was a video of a rally that was about to start, but they never went to her rally. So her supporters are understandably very angry because she didn't get much attention on the cable shows after that.
No, that's right.
I just want to say, I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, the idea of MSNBC weeping over Elizabeth Warren last night was almost hysterical because there was no network that ignored her more prior to that moment. I mean, it was simply astonishing what had happened. But anyway, you go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, why do you think that is, Helene? I mean, we're getting a lot of segments and shows today are talking about sexism. I hope that they will all, and that, of course, is pervasive, but I hope they'll also talk about the fact that Wall Street donors told the Democratic Party that if you back Elizabeth Warren, we're going to back Trump. I mean, this came out in CNBC in September, and that's really not getting much attention.
And that's around the time that Warren's numbers dipped, too. You know, a lot of her supporters said, oh, this is great free media that the corporate elite is going after our candidate. You know, and I, for someone like me who's very skeptical of the corporate elite, I saw this as a lot of Warren supporters did, as maybe a positive. But if you look at where her numbers started to dive, it was around then.
Helene?
Right, I would agree. I mean, the thing I noticed is that her numbers really went up over the summer and early fall when the economy looked really shaky. And then when the stock market started to pick up again in mid-October, suddenly her numbers took a nosedive. It was around that time, at the same time, that the real pushback occurred from the Wall Street crowd, because there was no question in my mind that they were very threatened by her. Elizabeth Warren, you know, not only doesn't like them, kind of has a sense of what levers to pull to really cause some pain. And I think there was a real fear of her, and you started to see a real concerted pushback, especially on places like MSNBC, like CNBC, where they were just giving much more time to the opponents, where you would see people literally on television crying over the thought of Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. I mean, it was people worth billions of dollars. And this was taken seriously, by the way. Nobody said, are you for real? They were treated with utmost respect when this happened, which was absurd.
Also, during that time period, Elizabeth Warren, her campaign and some of her surrogates have made kind of an overwhelmingly narrow critique on Bernie's online supporters, many of whom, have used nasty language, vitriol online. But, a lot of supporters of all the candidates have as well. But I want to focus on something else that happened in early October. And that's when, on the debate stage, Pete Buttigieg spent an entire 2 minutes really going after Elizabeth Warren, attacking her, saying, you have a plan for everything, but you don't have a plan for paying for your health care proposal. And then Amy Klobuchar joined that attack, and they spent a sustained 2 or 3 weeks going after Elizabeth Warren. And if you look at the kind of the polling average, Real Clear Politics does a composite of all the polls, and you can kind of see exactly when a candidate dives or goes up. And it was in the end of October, after that sustained attack by those two candidates, in addition to the healthcare lobby, which was running a lot of anti-Medicare for All, anti-public option ads in Iowa, in New Hampshire, And from this sustained attack, whether it was from Wall Street, from Pete, from Amy, from the media, we saw Elizabeth Warren's numbers tumble, and they just never recovered after that.
Hmm. Well, if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Li Fong is an investigative journalist for The Intercept. Helene Olin is an opinion writer at The Washington Post. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. What are your thoughts on the coverage of Super Tuesday and where we are right now? Let's hear from Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that, you know, there's a lot of talk about sort of the coverage and being in a, you know, in a silo about electability. And, you know, I have to say as a, you know, for the rest of the country, I'm an extremely liberal voter, but for the Bay Area, I'm a moderately liberal voter. And I feel like a lot of this conversation is really siloed. You know, 90% of people don't want to ban, of Americans don't want to ban private insurance. That's just a, like, on the merits, that's a really unpopular thing. And it's not, like, super surprising that, you know, the two candidates that were most closely associated with that and who, you know, didn't lead Biden in that many polls, you know, didn't come out ahead. I just wanted to sort of share, it feels, you know, tough for me to hear folks who I respect, as, you know, essentially discount my vote by saying, oh, I'm part of the corporate wing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if other folks, you know, votes were so easily discounted, we would think of that as being really disrespectful. But,
mm-hmm. you know, thank you.
Know, you. I feel, you know, pretty disrespected.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And I apologize. I mean, I think this is really important. And I wanted to talk to both of you about it because in one of our promos, I don't remember what we said exactly, but we just said, how will the corporate wing of the Democratic Party affect the election? And a few people who voted for Biden sent us emails saying that they were offended by that.
Yeah.
And it is not, I don't mean to offend. I understand. I mean, I have family members who voted for Biden. I don't think the machine made them vote for him. But I want to ask you about that. Well, both of you, but Lee, I mean, you spend so much time writing about big money in politics. So how should we describe this? What do we mean when we say corporate wing of the Democratic Party?
Well, there is a, you know, it's not a monolith, right? There's not one person pulling the strings on an entire wing of the party, but there is a small group of individuals, political operatives, lobbyists, former staffers who run the large foundations, the think tanks, the super PACs, who raise the six-figure checks that normal Americans could never provide for a candidate. And many of these individuals coalesced around Biden. Biden's super PAC was organized by a lobbyist for Raytheon. You know, his campaign has the de facto campaign manager is Anita Dunn, who runs one of the most powerful lobbying and public affairs firms in Washington. You know, this is someone who's represented many different corporate interests, whether that's the junk food lobby or the for-profit college industry, actually against Obama's reforms. So, you know, this is what I think folks mean when they mean the corporate wing or, you know, the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. But, you know, to your caller's point, I think it's an excellent one. I think the left, the progressive left, has come across in this election as lecturing, as condescending at times. Oftentimes, you know, I think folks on the political left believe that they know the best policy solution and that even if voters aren't with them on day one, they can kind of lecture and tell them what the best solution is. And if you look at what the Bernie campaign did in South Carolina, I think it's illustrative of this problem. You know, South Carolina is one of the most socially conservative states in the country, you know, maybe after Mississippi and Alabama. And if you look at the Biden ads, Biden's campaign ads, I think were very savvy and sophisticated. They emphasized his electability, which was a major concern for Democratic voters. They emphasized his patriotism. They emphasized his closeness with Obama, who's a very popular figure in South Carolina. If you look at Bernie's ads, there were ads about expunging people's criminal records and legalizing marijuana, which, you know, I can understand is a laudable policy position, something that I personally agree with. But for South Carolina voters, which, you know, not a state that's known for drug decriminalization or drug legalization, this might have come across as lecturing, right? Mm. And why would you run ads that are further to the left of the mainstream electorate and hope to receive their votes? So, you know, the Biden campaign deserves a lot of credit for just simply going to where the voters were, whereas Bernie, what appears to have happened is, you know, coming from the far left and hoping that the voters follow you.
Helene, what would you add? Did we lose Helene?
If you'd like.
Oh, we lost Helene. I think to add to what Chris said, I completely understand, because I think what's happening now is when you use the word moderate, you use it in a very negative way.
Mm.
And I know that we've done that. I mean, it's just like, well, you know, I've got a family member that is dealing with a mental health crisis right now, and I've seen the system from the inside, and it's horrific. And a lot of us would like to see major, major change. Other people think that that's not possible, or, you know, we have different opinions. But I can completely understand what he's saying. And I mean, we're in a time right now when there's so many crises, and so people want to see major changes.
That's true. But at the same time, you know, we have an extreme president in many ways. You know, this
right.
is a country that's been thrown into turmoil with a president that has shattered political norms, legal norms, has taken the country in many extreme ways. And maybe if you look at the voter base, if you look at the midterm elections, what was the big story of the midterm elections? Moderate suburban voters came out in droves. The big spike in voter turnout were in moderate suburbs who told pollsters, hey, we'd like a return to normalcy. We don't want revolutionary change. We want a return to the Obama years. We want a return to maybe even 30 years ago, where we didn't have such extreme immigration decisions, extreme rhetoric around Muslims. And maybe that's just where the electorate is now. We want a return to normalcy. We are afraid of revolutionary change, given what Trump has already given us.
Helene, are you back with us?
Back and
okay.
I'm sorry, I don't know what happened.
That's all right. What would you add? Were you able to catch most of that?
I caught the tail end of it. I think a couple of different things. I think that it's, as a general rule, when people perceive the economy to be decent, they're not looking to rock the boat. They're not looking to see revolutionary change. And I think that's something that the Democratic candidates are all up against to an extent. But I think it especially impacted the left-wing progressive part of the party for obvious reasons. They're arguing for more change. People they get afraid of what they're going to lose. That is a major thing. I think in terms of the, quote, corporate wing of the party, unquote, I think there's a bit of a divide between public perception and what reality sometimes is. And that's because we don't really talk about politics, especially on the TV networks, in terms of how it's funded and how it's done. It's often presented as a horse race and personalities. And people respond to specific candidates that aren't always responding to policy. So you get these, you get voters, for instance, who will say, I'm voting for Elizabeth Warren and my second choice is Joe Biden. And you think, how can that be? Because they don't share a lot of the same opinions. And in fact, Warren and Biden are actually, you know, we're adversaries at many points over the years. But yet that is how voters think, because this is who they like. And they vote sometimes based on likability and on impressions. And that's an important part of this as well.
Right. Excuse me. And in fact, Elizabeth Warren on March 2nd, I just want to find this story so I don't misquote her. She said, no matter how many Washington insiders tell you to support Biden, nominating their fellow Washington insider will not meet this moment. Nominating a man who says we do not need any fundamental change in this country will not meet this moment. So Elizabeth Warren is calling them insiders.
Right, but that's
exactly.
Not the message that voters hear. I mean, they hear that, but if, as Elaine mentioned, like, watch MSNBC for 3 sustained hours. You don't hear that.
Right. Right. And I mean, I think we should also remember that, you know, voters are, I think activists are generally getting a lot of their info from, say, places like Twitter, but the more general voters are getting stuff from the news networks, from Facebook. So you're getting different silos of information, and I think that's really important. So you kind of had this idea, if you were on, journalists tend to be on Twitter, I think, which is probably part of what the shock was. And, you know, people, you know, older voters as a rule are more likely to be on Facebook and watching television. I think that played into all of this as well.
Well, and it's you know, we're constantly thinking about this. When we did shows about the presidential candidates, we got slammed by people saying, why are you slamming Amy Klobuchar's environmental record? She got a D from the Center for Biological Diversity. Why are you slamming Biden for saying he would cut Medicare? Why are you doing this when we need to defeat Trump? Just stop it and let's defeat Trump. But
right, and I think part of this too is, you know, there's this kind of incoherence at the heart of all of this. Trump, you know, Trump didn't come out of nowhere, but I think a lot of people would like to think he came out of nowhere. I think it's more comforting to think that Trump came out of nowhere, that, you know, that we could just simply go back, right? And it's like that, I've been joking, it's like that season of Dallas when I was a kid, where it turned out to all be a dream and it wasn't real, and, you know, it just reset. And I think that's kind of what voters want, right? That, you know, we could all go back and we just pretend Barack Obama never, you know, he had his third term. This whole Trump thing was a dream, and, you know, or a nightmare, as the case may be, to be more accurate. But that's not how it works. This happened for a reason. And my long-term fear is that at some point voters are going to realize this, either before, you know, in the worst case scenario, before Biden gets, you know, if Biden is the nominee, before he is elected. Because we have actually no guarantee that this is going to stack. I mean, one of the things I wrote about this week is the whole election season has been waves of support, just in waves. Biden did terribly in Iowa and New Hampshire, and then he suddenly comes out of nowhere. How do we know this is going to stick? The answer is we don't.
Right.
We're just sort of going with, you know, the most recent past, which in this case is about 72 hours.
Right.
No, I think that's exactly on point. And just to get back to this generational divide, you know, we have such a polarized country, but especially among generation, among age. And if you just look at the numbers, younger people, more highly educated people receive their news from elite media sources that have a paywall, New York Times or Financial Times or Wall Street Journal, or they're using Twitter and they're kind of doing their own research on the policy position of the candidates, because you can receive a lot of just a fire hose of information using those sources. And older voters tend to use more broadcast media, radio, television, cable news. And you receive a completely different narrative. And if you, again, look at the actual turnout numbers, South Carolina, 530,000 people turned out in 2008, and that was a huge record. In 2016, those numbers were dismal. It was less than 400,000, and that kind of was an omen for the general election. I'm talking about just about the primary here. And then in this year, the numbers surged again. Almost to the same 2008 level, but if you look at it from a precinct by precinct level, the Washington Post did an analysis of this. The actual surges of turnout came out in Charlottesville suburbs and Rock Hill suburbs. These are the whiter, wealthier, older suburbs. So that there's a revolution in our politics happening. There is higher turnout, but it's among a certain demographic that receives a certain type of news.
Got to cut it right here. I would love to have you both back to continue this conversation. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist for The Intercept. Helene Olin is an opinion writer at The Washington Post. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Thank you for the call. Thank you for all of the emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.